Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. Obviously, the show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we made it to another week, and AMC is backpedaling. I haven't seen this much backpedaling since Ali and Zaire. They're going to open up eventually, but they're asking you to wear masks because they don't want to make it into a political thing. There you go. So I hope you were able to watch a good movie in the confines of your home or office, living room, what have you. And we'll get to your list as well as my list in a little bit. But this is a special week, folks, because I'm going to dip into the interview archives not once, but twice. These are your pledge dollars at work, and I get a chance to replay some of these fun chats. We're going to start with the brief but sweet quality time I had with Padma Lakshmi. She has a new series on Hulu called Taste the Nation. It seems like everybody's picking up the Anthony Bourdain torch as far as traveling to different places and experiencing their food and discussing and experiencing the culture and what is happening in the world with the location and their food. So just started it last night with the first episode set in El Paso and Juarez, Mexico. And I'll be watching more of those hopefully over the weekend. But yeah, short and sweet, here's my chat with Padma.
Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Padma. How are you?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
We're hanging here in Indianapolis.
I'm good. We're just we're sitting here drinking up some coffee. Very happy, jittery people.
Well, that's good to know. When it comes to summer, what is the first dish that you think of?
Well, you know, I think there's nothing so classic in summer as ice cream. And I'm going to show you how to dress up ice cream and make it into a fabulous dessert and give your guests a coffee all rolled into one. And the recipe is so easy, but if you don't write it down, it's on Nespresso.com. Basically, Nespresso makes these great espresso machines. Their coffee machines are renowned all over the world. And they basically have a Pixie machine, which is the one I love. It comes in a lot of colors. You pop the little capsule of coffee in. It's the best possible coffee. You make the espresso. You just take a beautiful, simple scoop of vanilla ice cream, put it in a coffee cup, pour the espresso hot over it, sprinkle some chocolate chips, and drizzle some caramel sauce. That is it. You could add nuts. You could add cinnamon. You know, you could add peanut butter chips, but that's the basic recipe. And again, if your listeners are driving or whatever, it's on the website. Go to Nespresso.com.
Sounds like a good movie treat as well.
It's awesome, honestly. They have this beautiful milk machine called the Arachino, and it's basically you just plug it in and it steams up the milk and gives you that foam, just like those high-end coffee bars all across Italy and Switzerland and France. It foams everything up. It steams the milk in 1 second. It's beautiful. Actually, probably about 30 seconds. But it's so easy to do.
Well, can you tell us a little bit of what's in store for season 10 of Top Chef?
Well, we haven't filmed it yet, so there's not much I can tell you. We're in pre-production right now. I think we're just all racking our brains and figuring out how we're going to top Texas from last season. I mean, we had such an incredible season, and we're just gearing to shoot. It'll probably be on the fall, And I think we're trying to shake it up again. I think you'll see a lot of surprises. I mean, you know, Charlize Theron and Patti LaBelle were on last season, so who knows who they'll come up with this season.
Padma, we can top Texas, Indianapolis.
Sounds good to me.
So I was curious, when you see somebody cooking in a movie, do you pay extra special attention to see if they're actually doing it right?
You know, that's a great question. I do, actually. I'm a big freak about continuity because, you know, I come from theater and I've done a couple of movies, and so I can always tell when there's not continuity or when someone's phoning it in. And, like, you know that scene in Jerry Maguire where Renee Zellweger answers the door? Watch it. When they cut to his view, her necklace is tied differently.
Ah, yes. So movie-wise, who can cook?
You know what? Stanley Tucci can cook his face off. That is not, he is not playing. Everything in Big Night is very authentic.
Great
so
film.
So can Martin Scorsese. His first student film was a film about his mom's spaghetti sauce. He gave me a copy of it. It's brilliant.
And didn't she do all the cooking in that one kitchen scene in Goodfellas?
Yes. That's an incredible scene.
So anytime we're going to see you in a movie anytime soon?
I have a couple of offers, but my problem is my scheduling. You know, mm-hmm. You have to really do one thing and do it well. I haven't been in a movie since I started Top Chef 5 years ago. My last film was for the BBC. I would love to do another film. It just has to be the right one and work with the schedule, which is not always easy. I'm just thankful for my job on Top Chef at this point.
Of course. Padma, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care, Matthew.
All right, you too. From 2012, that was my interview with Padma Lakshmi. Her new series, Taste the Nation, is now available on Hulu. One of the films the Soucy family got to watch over the past week, you know, dinner, family time, my daughter finally got to experience Guillermo del Toro's award-winning, Best Picture winner, The Shape of Water. And with that, here's one of the stars of The Shape of Water, my pal and fellow Ball State graduate, the Ball State University. Here's my chat with actor Doug Jones. Joining me on Film Sociology is actor and, full disclosure, fellow Ball State graduate, fellow Cardinal, Doug Jones. How are you, Doug?
I like this. I'm doing great, but full disclosure, like it's normally a secret.
No, I think the fact that we sort of know each other.
We go back.
We need to go back a little bit. Now, first off, I have to say, it has been quite the week for Doug Joneses.
Oh, well tell me about it. You know, in this age of social media, I didn't realize how much one can be tagged in the wrong hashtag. Right?
So what? When did it start? I mean, did it start obviously election night, or did it start before?
Oh, it started before. You know, as the campaign was heating up in Alabama, the other Doug Jones, we were getting some cross pollination on our fan bases or our hate bases, whatever it was. In fact, even my manager's office even got calls and emails in support of or in detest of me, and not realizing it was the wrong Doug Jones they were calling about.
So how many times have you had to address this online?
Well, I put up one post on all my social media platforms the day after the election just to say, hey, everybody, thanks for your concern, not me.
Well, despite that, 2017 has been quite the year. I'm happy to say you are the star, the non-human star of The Shape of Water, which opened this past week. And I guess I want to go back with, how did you get in touch, or how did you become a part of the Guillermo del Toro players?
Oh, golly, we go back 20 years. We met in 1997 when he was doing his first American studio film, which was Mimic. Mm-hmm. And I was called in. I was referred to him by the creature effects people who had worked on the movie in Toronto, and they were doing some pickup shots in L.A. So I only worked for the last 3 days of the film shoot as a bug creature for him. And it was during our lunch break on the second day of that 3 days that he sat across the table from me, put his chin in his hands, and said, "So, Dougie, tell me everything you've been in before." So I started rattling off my resume, and at that point I had done things like, this is 97, so I'd done like Warriors of Virtue and Tank Girl, two movies in which I played a kangaroo man. Mm-hmm. I'd done Hocus Pocus, playing Billy the Zombie already by then. and had done a ton of commercials, including the iconic Mac Tonight campaign for McDonald's, where
That's right.
The crescent moon head that sang at the, atop a piano. He knew every makeup artist I'd ever worked with, and he loved creepy crawly monsters and wanted to hear more about them. And I knew then that I was dealing with a man who was unlike any other director I had ever met in my life. And he that day became my favorite and has remained so for the last 20 years.
And he's used you ever on almost every film, is that right, since?
Since then, let's see, since we met on Mimic, he did The Devil's Backbone and then Blade 2 without me, both of those. Then came back around for me on Hellboy 1.
Right.
And that came out in theaters in 2004. And then Ben Pan's Labyrinth, then Hellboy 2, then Crimson Peak, and now The Shape of Water. This is my sixth film with him now, and I also was a recurring vampire for him on his TV show, The Strain. So we've been through a lot together in those 20 years.
Do you guys have a shorthand when it comes to working together?
Yes. He's the kind of director, he sums up every actor upon meeting. He's a people studier. Mm-hmm. So once he knows the actor he's working with, he kind of develops a control panel on each one of us with a series of buttons to push to get a reaction or an adjustment out of us on the day while we're filming. So he develops kind of a shorthand with everybody he works with. But now he knows me so well now, though, that he knows if he can make me chuckle, I'll hear him and I'll know what adjustment to make. For instance, when we were working on Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, there was one scene where the camera was dollying around me, and I was doing a piece of action with no dialogue in that scene, just like picking up a thing and doing a thing with a prop. And after take one, he said, "Dougie, cut. You're boring me to tears." That's all I had to hear, and I laughed, and I made the adjustment he needed. And so we kind of in Pan's Labyrinth, I played the Fawn and the Pale Man in that movie.
Right. I think everybody knows you for the Eyeballs for Hands guy.
The Eyeballs in the Hands guy, yeah. While playing that character, when I stood up and started walking after I awakened and was trying to chase little Ivana Baquero as my dinner, I was a bit too gangly, a bit too loose jointed, and he said, no, cut. And then he said, "Give me a George Romero zombie." That's all I needed to hear. And
yep.
Went back and did it again, and we never discussed it again. And in Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, I did three characters. I reprised my role of Abe Sapien, the Bluefish guy. I played the Angel of Death. And I played the Chamberlain, which is a lesser-known character, but he was in a couple of key scenes. And in that one, it was a kind of a boxy-headed guy with really long, spindly fingers. And he said, "Dougie, when you play the Chamberlain, I want you to give him sort of a ew." He made that noise, drew his fingers together, and tilted his head. I'm like, "Yep, got it." And that's all the more we discussed. So I think when you make a sound effect and a hand gesture, we can call that a shorthand, can't we?
That's almost like Dr. English, really.
I know.
Sorry, Ball State humor. What's funny, Doug, is going through, and if you go to Doug Jones' IMDb page, you've seen him in one way, shape, or form. And you've heard of character actors being known as that guy or that lady, and the fact that you have a lot of fill-in-the-blank guy. You know, everything
right,
from the Bye-Bye Man, as you said, to, you know, Fish Guy, to the, you know, your Amphibian Man, of course, in Shape of Water. You're him.
Right. And including this, I'm having quite a year right now. The Shape of Water is coming out in theaters now. Right now, in fact, it opens in Indianapolis tonight.
Yes,
or today, the 15th. I think it's only in a couple of key theaters there, and then it's going to open wide nationwide in all the multiplexes and everything on the 22nd. So there's the date difference, but so Indianapolis is getting it a week before the rest of the nation, which I'm very excited about.
Well,
my hometown.
So are we. So thank you for that.
Yeah, of course, of course. What was the question?
I think it's a way of, you have a way of being recognized and not being recognized at the same time. Although, you know, you also have Star Trek on your hands.
That's talking about the year I was having. Right. I'm right now on hiatus from between seasons 1 and 2 of Star Trek Discovery, so it's a perfect time for the movie to come out, so I can actually focus on promoting that. But CBS All Access is, if you log on to CBS.com All Access, you'll see their entire catalog that's available there for subscription, and including the original series Star Trek Discovery, which is made just for CBS All Access. So that's the place you can see it. And it's a huge, big production that is carrying on the legacy and the, of this beloved franchise. And we, our show actually takes place 10 years before the original series, before Kirk and Spock. So we're kind of a build-up to the Starship Enterprise.
Were you a fan of Star Trek growing up?
You can't not be, really. I was born in 1960. So I when the original series was on TV in its network first run, I was watching it with my family on our black and white TV. So I absolutely loved it, the possibilities and the way it made you wonder about what else is out there. And of course, it opens up, it expands your mind a bit. And then every incarnation since then, whether it was Next Generation or Voyager, Deep Space Nine, Enterprise, and all the movies, I've loved them all. And as an actor who's worn lots of rubber bits over my 30-year career, I get asked all the time, "Have you ever done anything in Star Trek?" And I hadn't. So now that I'm 57 years old, I can finally say yes. I'm so excited about it.
And we figured, and it's interesting what you can get, I should put this, it's interesting what you can get across message-wise if you set it in science fiction or fantasy, as far as messages.
Absolutely. I think that, and that's something that Guillermo del Toro will talk about, too, with The Shape of Water. We can escape into a fantasy world, whether it's a fairy tale or it's Once Upon a Time in 1962 is kind of how The Shape of Water comes about.
Yep.
It takes you out of the world you're in right now and maybe parallels some things that are happening in our world today, but empowers you to, you delve into it with a fish man at the centerpiece of the movie and what he's going through, what the young lady played by Sally Hawkins is going through, the love story that builds there, and the obstacles that they're given, and everyone else in the movie: Octavia Spencer, Michael Shannon, Michael Stuhlbarg, Richard Jenkins. All these beautiful actors have characters that are so well-rounded and well-layered, and everyone has a full story to tell.
Yep.
And every story involves love and how they're dealing with it, how they're seeking it, and and the challenges they have in finding it. But I think the ultimate story of it is you come out of the theater empowered to go to say, I can tackle the monsters in my real life. I can tackle the love issues in my real life, and love is possible, even if I feel unlovely, and even if I feel like I'm a monster that no one would ever find attractive. It is possible, and we can find the beauty in that monster instead of the horror of it.
This is Shape of Water is my favorite love story of the year, and it's true. And I would have even if I didn't know you.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind.
Because it fits the element of I love unconventional love stories, or love stories that when you describe the story and then you have to tag it with, well, it just so happens. So it just so happens it's a deaf custodian with a fish guy.
Right. You have a mute janitor lady,
right,
who is working at a secret government test facility. And I'm an asset who's been acquired in the Amazon in South America. And I'm being tested. And she finds me, connects with me, comes to visit me on her nighttime lunch breaks and her night shift. And love brews from that.
Yep.
On paper, that looks ridiculous. But... In the filming process, you have Guillermo del Toro at the helm directing this, and he wrote it. So of course it's going to work because he's the one filmmaker who could pull this one off.
As I watched it, I mean these comparisons as a compliment. I've been telling people, and I've told people on the show, imagine Beauty and the Beast, Splash, and the Iron Giant kind of rolled into one, but it's written and directed by Guillermo del Toro. So
boom,
it's
there's your one-liner right
it's,
there.
It's R-rated. There's Michael Shannon's buttocks. There's a scene with Michael Stuhlbarg's cheek, and I don't want to give it away, but there's several lovely moments with you and Sally Hawkins. One that happens in the final third of the film, I don't see coming.
Yes,
and,
my favorite movie.
And I will say, I'm like, okay, this is another reason why Doug took it. And it also does a part of your Ball State training that I don't think you've been able to utilize in film in a while.
You are correct, sir.
Okay, that's wonderfully gray and specifically vague. Good.
I love it. Good, good, good. But that, there's that. We didn't spoil anything. I think we just enticed some interest right there.
And, you know, as somebody who sees films a lot, to be pleasantly gobsmacked by a moment of like, oh, because you're like, okay, guy and girl and a fish, I can run with this. That's fine. Oh, wow. So, yeah, this film gets you with surprises.
Yeah, it does indeed.
So get through the process. So give me through a morning. You, what time do you arrive, and how much time does it take for you to prepare for Amphibian Man?
Right. Well, normally for a Guillermo del Toro movie, over the 7 projects I've done with him now, I have played 12 creatures for him in the all that, because I've done double duty several times.
Right.
Every creature I've played for him usually takes between 5 and 7 hours to put on me. But the Amphibian Man in The Shape of Water was a merciful 3 hours. But my call time was still before everybody else's, and my wrap time at the end of the night was after everybody else's, so my days were long. I was doing the 17, 18-hour days. It's a common, but the makeup process was done on me by Legacy Effects, which is a renowned makeup creature house here in Los Angeles, and they had a lot of those pieces pre-made for me. So I did tons of fittings for months before the movie started filming. So that's when they were doing the sculpting on a life cast of me to make it fit me and only me, mm-hmm. and that would be sculpting and painting prosthetic pieces that would be glued onto me or slipped onto me and zipped up the back, and gills that were operated by mechanical puppeteers off camera. And so it took a village to make this character come together. But on set then, once all that pre-work has been done, on set the makeup artists had the chore of piecing all this together. The puzzle was getting it all on me in the right places, and then connecting the paint job that was already started back in the shop, and finishing up and making it seamless and making it pretty and ready for film. So there you go. So that's how I spent my 3 hours, and hopefully we'd have some music playing, or if we had a laptop open, we could watch a talking cat video on YouTube to entertain me.
I would say, are you able to sleep during this process at all?
Well, not all of it, but okay. Because when they're working around you 360 degrees around your body, and you have to stand some of the time,
okay,
and shimmying into the body part of it is not a sit down relaxed thing. It took 3 adult men sweating and huffing and puffing to get me in that suit, because it was skin tight. Mm-hmm. It was made because I had to bend and move in all directions without causing wrinkles. So that meant many adjustments and a lot of tight.
So what music did got you through the process?
Well, you know, your creature effects makeup artists are guys who love heavy metal. So that does not relax me or get me started for my day at all, especially in a about to tell a romantic tale. So I would ask, can we put on some vintage Mariah Carey or Whitney Houston? I love a good gutsy ballad from one of those ladies. And then I'll be ready to do a love scene.
Although Whitney and Water, that didn't end well.
Oh, you had to go there, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm a terrible host. I'm sorry.
I know.
So were you able to have a rehearsal process before shooting? And I asked that because of the intimacy with you and Sally Hawkins in the film. Wonderful chemistry.
Well, the scene that we were not speaking of, this particular surprise scene, involved some specific choreography of where our bodies should go and how they should go.
Yeah. Well, that too.
So we did have 3 weeks of rehearsal time together before the cameras rolled. So that bought us a lot of – those 3 weeks – not only did we work out where our feet should go, but we also had downtime to giggle together, cry together sometimes, share our secrets and stories and our insecurities even. I mean, we were both terrified of this movie because we both had vulnerable, intimate scenes to play together. And we also, she had to learn American Sign Language.
Yes.
She had to learn, again, this choreography I'm talking about. And she also had to disrobe in a couple times in the movie to carry out some love scenes.
Yeah, I was going to say, folks, there is a shower scene, but not what you expect.
No, it's with a fish man that changes everything.
Well, that too, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's, to be able to open yourself up and, because there's been a lot of change in the business lately. So the fact that an actress of the caliber of Sally's to open herself up physically that much and trusting you and trusting Guillermo, I mean, it says a lot. And it'll make some people uncomfortable, but that's, I mean, film is hopefully going to do that in all the right ways.
Yeah. It's rated R because it does push some limits with those images, but it's a part of his storytelling and the movie has kind of a French feeling to it, and you know, and the French movies they throw topless women around like candy, you know. So, this is not gratuitous at all. It's really
correct.
It's done with an artistic flair, and for everything has a reason. He doesn't do anything without a reason behind it. So I think he did want to show her sexuality as a thing of beauty and an unrealized thing in her life, because as you meet her at the beginning of the film, she has a very set routine every day. She boils her eggs in water. She masturbates in water. She brushes her shoes and goes to work. So she is a very, very set routine. So when she rescues me from this government test facility before they finally kill me, she stops that from happening because with her little rescue escape plan for me, with her friends Octavia Spencer and Richard Jenkins pulling together to help this happen, I end up in her bathtub, the same place where she was pleasuring herself before. So it's kind of like a full circle thing where this alone lifestyle that she had is now involves another being, and can this work? And you find yourself as an audience kind of rooting for it to work somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I did when I watched the movie back. It's like, yeah, I want those two to get together, and I am one of them. So, yeah.
Is this the most water work you've done for a project?
Yes, by far, because when I played Abe Sapien in the Hellboy movies, I was never really in water. That was all either hanging on wires, shooting dry for wet, and which we did do some in the Shape of Water as well. We shot some dry for wet with a smoke-filled studio and lighting effect rippling through it, and us hanging on wires with fans blowing on us. And they add some CG production afterwards with bubbles and hair movement. But I was in water this time. I was in the flooded bathroom scene is real water. It's an 8-foot tank that they built that bathroom set in, and the pool area of the laboratory where I'm chained, that is also, of course, real water that I have to come up out of or dive back into. So I had to start many takes of many scenes by hearing the cameras rolling, holding my breath, going under, counting to three, and then coming back up to start my acting. So.
They didn't teach
challenges that I hadn't had in anything before.
They didn't throw us in a pool at Ball State.
Mm-mm.
I learn.
I think I had a swimming. I passed some swimming tests during a PE course. I think in the pool.
But you didn't have one of the. You didn't have one of the profs telling you to pontificate or revert back to childhood memories.
No, right. It was in the PE department, not in the theater department. Correct.
Sorry, it just cracks me up. Were you able to interact with the rest of the cast, or was there a separation between you and the rest of the human cast?
No. We Guillermo encouraged us to socially get together ahead of time. And again, like I told you, the rehearsal time with Sally, we built a trust and a deep affection for each other that hopefully, by the time the cameras did roll, we had hopefully some romantic chemistry to play on film, and. Octavia Spencer and Michael Stuhlbarg, who played our one of the lead scientists, and he was a scientist that had a heart toward
me.
He actually had an affection for the fish man, his love affair was with science. And Michael Stuhlbarg, by the way, a side note, he's also currently being touted for some Oscar buzz for Call Me by Your Name with his supporting role in that.
Indeed,
But we also, and then Michael Shannon was the one. Guillermo del Toro would have dinners for the cast a lot. He loves eating together. Guillermo's bonding time is over food. So we would all get together for dinners throughout the entire production. And he kept Michael Shannon away from us for a while. Michael Shannon played our nemesis. He was kind of the bad guy of the movie. And he kind of kept us apart until about maybe halfway through the production, when he started inviting him to our cast dinners. And he did that kind of on purpose, so that when we were working with him, that there was a sense of unfamiliarity and a sense of antagonism coming from him still.
And at the very least, check out Michael Shannon on Funny or Die. It's one of my favorite pieces of acting he's ever done, and it's one of my favorite things on Funny or Die, where he reads the sorority letter.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So, I mean, and then you guys were able to connect in a different way with the film junket. So how many hotel suites have you guys been hanging out in?
Oh, my goodness. Between Los Angeles and New York, we've been back and forth. I'm just finishing up week three of doing PR and promotion and press for the movie. So, just a lot. I can't even tell. Countless.
So I guess back to the water thing. How's your ear pressure?
Oh, well, that's something that I don't think anybody – I'm going to give you an exclusive bit of information right now
that
I have not talked about in any of my interviews over the past 3 weeks. I just forgot about it until now. During the production, I got an ear infection because the water that was trapped in my prosthetic makeup that was trapped in my head kind of lingered in my ears for a while. And I had some wax buildup. And both my ears got infected, and I had to go to a doctor and get some special drops.
Jeez. Oh, God. Well, it's that Ball State journalism education that I ask that. And
yes, of course. You have to investigative journalism.
Exactly.
Right there, folks.
I say, you guys talked about bonding over dinner. Could you have seafood?
Oh, yes. I'm totally a cannibal. Absolutely.
In high school, I read The Jungle and ate a hot dog at the same time.
You go, baby.
Exactly. And so will you have a new appreciation for Esther William films now after working on this?
Oh, totally. Yeah. In fact, while filming The Shape of Water in Toronto, I had an apartment there in the city. While filming, and thank heaven we had AMC and Turner Classics, TCM movies, and I watched a bunch of old films, and they were having an Esther Williams marathon one day, and I was like, oh, this is big, perfect. So watching how smooth and effortless she looked in the water, it's like that honestly did help inspire. Believe it or not, I know you're kidding, but it actually did help.
Well, I think as an actor, when you work on a particular aspect, for example, I don't know if you know the Tom Stoppard play, The Real Inspector Hound.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
I was in a production of it at Earlham. I had to play a corpse. Hmm. So I was dead on stage for 50 minutes, and then the director, Mickey Wyatt, said, I need you on stage when House opens. Mm-hmm. So I'm dead for an hour and 20 minutes.
Oh.
But so that aspect of after that, like watching Julius Caesar, I'm like, I'm watching the guy playing Caesar dead on the floor. You know, so I think now forever you're going to notice acting when it's done in water.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Am I ever? Yeah.
I want to go to this is I and oh, by the way, because the last time I had you on the show, you alluded to Guillermo was saying he had a pet project for you. Was this it? Or was there something else? I couldn't remember because I know there was rumors that I think he was trying to make a Kong film or his own Godzilla film, if I remember correctly.
I believe it was his own Frankenstein film.
Frankenstein. Sorry.
Right.
Okay.
And I believe that's what I might have been alluding to last because I think last time I haven't been on your show.
It's been a while. Too long.
Years? How long has it been?
No, it hasn't been that long. I think it was right when you were doing Crimson Peak. I think.
Oh, well, okay. Crimson Peak was, 2014, 15.
Right. So this should just be an annual event, Doug. I love having
And if it was 2014 or 15, then yes, I was referring to The Shape of Water by then.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. So
yes, because that was I was sworn to secrecy for a while because I heard about it. Yeah, he first pulled me aside to talk to me about it while we were filming Crimson Peak in Toronto. Had a day off, and he called me into his office that day to discuss The Shape of Water behind closed doors, and I was sworn to secrecy. So that was almost 4 years ago we had that talk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I want to go back a little bit. I also am on – I did this the last time we talked. I'm on your IMDb page.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to find out what's true and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do want to mention it was fun taking my daughter to see The Bye Bye Man.
Yeah.
Because anytime you came on screen, Emma, not being scared, would just go, Dougie.
Oh, good. Okay.
And, you know, we're laughing our heads off. And I know people laugh at horror films, but it was we, we had a different laughter for different reasons. So.
And the Bye-Bye Man is full of those laughs. I totally understand. I totally understand.
So okay, so here's what is been listed as announced, pre-production, post-production, completed, whatever. We're going to find out, Doug Jones, did this actually happen or not?
Oh, good, okay.
There was something announced called Zero Dawn of the Darklighters.
Right. That is a I voiced the character of Zero, the robot, and the robot who is on a space journey.
Okay.
I voiced that role before they went into production. I don't know if they've ever gone into production. I've never heard a follow-up about that. So I was in a sound studio in San Diego, California. I voiced the entire feature film, and I got paid. So as far as I'm concerned, it's a valid credit.
All right. So long as definitely when the check clears.
Right.
The Legacy of Avril Kite, where you're listed as Dr. Stewart.
Right. Read the script, liked it, said, yes, I'd love to do this. It has been on my IMDb page in pre-production ever since for the last, 4 years maybe? I don't know. I don't know if it's ever going to get made, child. I have no idea.
Okay. Next, Hell's Kitty, where you play Father Damien.
Yes, was a web series that was called Hell's Kitty, and I did play that character. It was hilarious. I was and the other, Bill Oberst, is a horror iconic actor who was he was a priest with me. We were doing an exorcist spoof in that particular episode of this web series, Hell's Kitty. They're compiling that footage back together again for over the entire web series to make a feature film out of it. So I think that's why the credit shows up a couple times as completed and in pre-production, because it's the recompilation that they're working on as a feature.
Okay. A TV movie called Nazareth, where you are President Glade.
Yes, that was I did film that, and I at Asbury University in Wilmore, Kentucky. I have a scholarship fund there. Actually, it's because I have a family legacy at that university. My grandfather was vice president of that university back in the black and white days. So I joined their theater and film department last year to play the role of a university president in a TV pilot that has yet to see the light of day. But it's they made it, and they had. It was one of those immersive learning experiences where they brought in Anson Williams from Happy Days to direct.
Okay.
To direct, and we had Nancy Stafford from
Too Close for Comfort, among other things.
Right.
The In-Laws.
And then me also in the cast, and then they cast locally out of Louisville and Lexington and Cincinnati. They brought actors in from all over, and used as a learning tool for the students at Asbury to be on the production staff and the crew of this TV pilot. So we made a real show, and it's actually quite charming. I hope, but I don't know if it's ever going to get sold. That's what pilots do. We don't know.
You're right. Okay, got two more here. One called The Fifth Passenger, where you play Langdon.
Yes, just saw the premiere of that two nights ago. They had a premiere screening here in Hollywoodland at the Grauman's Chinese Theater. So that is completed and done. It's another space adventure, and I play a human being in it who is the billionaire the trillionaire who financed the space program in question.
What is your ratio of human to non-human characters, do you think?
It's probably right. I think if you look at my entire IMDb list, it's roughly like maybe I would say 60-40 in favor of creatures.
Okay. Well, you're still working, so.
Yeah. So, the creatures have afforded me longevity that I wouldn't have with my own face.
I'm not saying that. And then finally, here's somewhere in between, Count Orlok in a production of Nosferatu.
Ooh, that's a for real, and that's coming. That'll be available to be seen next year, 2018.
Okay.
It is a you might want to call it a remake, but it's actually a remix. So my director created matte shots off the original film and filmed us in front of green screen and plopped the two together. Added dialogue he didn't rewrite it or retool it or reimagine it. The dialogue is actually very fitting to the silent film that you know well.
Okay.
So he wrote dialogue that would express verbally what you were watching in the original silent film.
And you don't have to be Klaus Kinski.
And I did get to play the iconic role of Count Orlok, originally screened by Max Schreck.
Yep.
So yeah, that was a lifelong dream of mine. That was
really?
That was my bucket list character that I have never gotten to play. And now that I've played him, it's like, I think I could be done after this. I don't know.
Well, what do you, I mean, especially if you're doing creatures, what kind of physical, are there specific workouts you can do, training, to get you prepared for something? Is your workout different for Orlok compared to Amphibian Man?
Yes. Basically, once I look at a script and see what's required of me physically, I'll know. Okay, because especially if a creature has to squat a lot, you know, if you do that bent leg, you know, hunchback, mm-hmm. like kind of thing, you have to get strong in that position. And even for Saru on Star Trek Discovery, I'm up in a high heeled position, so my calves have to be of some strength. But I'm in hoof feet, so it's a high-heeled shoe without a heel behind it. So I'm actually have to work on my balance so that I don't, so that I'm not teetering on film too much. So it depends on the role completely.
Okay. So you mentioned your age earlier, but how are your joints?
You know what? For 57, I am holding up remarkably well when it comes to joints and hips, and I can still put my legs behind my head like a contortionist. So. I haven't thrown anything out yet, so let's knock on something. Right?
Knock on something for that. So, I'd say you're going to be, if you're not already in the award season, so more travel. You're going to be able to hit the award shows, or are you stuck with work?
Well, no, I'm actually on hiatus right now from Star Trek Discovery, so I've got a couple months off here. So, it looks like I'll be free to, if invited to award shows, I will be able to attend, it looks like. But
I think it should be mandatory. I want, especially at the Academy Awards, I'm going to shoot big. I want to see you and Andy Serkis present together in green suits. And white dots, covered in white dots and in a green bodysuit.
Except that Andy Serkis is the one who does that, and I wear the practical makeups.
Well, great. Then
I've never done motion capture.
You're out. Well, then now you have your each outfits, and then you can just stare at each other. Waiting for Godot.
If he comes out with a green leotard and dots on, and I come out in like ram horns and hoof feet and talons, there you go.
And then do Waiting for Godot. See, there's your next project.
Okay. Boom.
Doug, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciate it, and congratulations with the film. I hope a school of people go see it.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I've never been happier. Having a great year, and it's always a huge pleasure to talk to you and all my folks back home in Indianapolis.
Has Ball State bothered you for more money yet?
No. Well, I have a scholarship fund there as well, by the way. The Doug Jones Scholarship Fund for the theater and dance department. So they've got my money.
All right. Doug, have a great holiday.
You too, Matt. Thanks so much.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. From 2017, that was the second interview I ever conducted with Doug Jones on these airwaves with this show. So we did that because the Socies, as a trio, watched The Shape of Water on Thursday evening. My daughter had not experienced it yet, and she loved it. It was one of those where she immediately wanted to know who won Best Actress that year, because she thought Sally Hawkins should have. And then I told her it was Frances McDormand for Three Billboards, and she got frustrated. So anyway, no, it was good to revisit that. And anytime we can get a movie and dinner time as a trio in my household, that is a big deal, because the 18-year-old's getting older and will be going away to college soon. So enjoy these days while you can, folks. That's a little bit of advice from me. All right. Before I get into what I watch, let's go around. Of course, the drive-ins are open. Probably a safer step into seeing stuff as opposed to the movie theater. I'm not quite ready to go inside a movie theater yet, even though I have a rewards card from one particular chain. Although they've had a really bad PR hit earlier this week. Anyway, at the Tibbs Drive-In, we have on one screen one, we have Infamous and The Invisible Man. On screen two, Miss Juneteenth. And a good Juneteenth to everybody this weekend. On screen two, you have Miss Juneteenth. And on the second movie, The High Note. Screen three, Old School. They're going with Jurassic Park and Jaws. And then on screen four, wow, the original Gone in 60 Seconds, not the Nicolas Cage remake, along with The Short History of the Long Road. That is happening over at the Tibbs Drive-In. At the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, also going old school, Michael Keaton double feature, Beetlejuice, and Night Shift. That was the first one that was the film that put him on the map. So, and tell Shelley Long to call me. All right, so that is happening over there. I want to talk a little bit. There were some new, well, a new film that is available online this week. And then I got to one of the big films that was available online last week and streaming last week. But there's an Australian drama that came out in 2019. We're just getting it here in the States, called Baby Teeth. And it's about a teenage girl who is seriously ill, who falls for a slight – she's 16 and she falls for a slightly older, mid-20s, young boy who happens to be a drug dealer. Her parents' worst nightmare, as I guess it would be said. And what happens when he is incorporated into the family dynamic, especially because she's nearing death as it gets closer and closer. So this we've had a number of dying teenager movies the last few years, you know, Fault in Our Stars and the others like that. This one is really well made as far as the complicated aspect of it, because she is dying, and it is a love affair for her to have at a young age, and when he is incorporated in, and as a couple with the young couple as well as the mother and father, some days are just better than others, and that's the thing I think the film does best, is showing us pure bliss one day and just going down the crapper in the other, which can happen in life and relationships. Four really good performances from the girl is Eliza Scanlon. For those, she was Beth in Greta Gerwig's Little Women. Toby Wallace is the boy. Her parents are played by Ben Mendelsohn. I always love seeing Ben Mendelsohn playing non-smarmy, non-psycho role, so I'm really excited for him. And Essie Davis, the mom from The Babadook, plays the mother. And as you see the time that these four have together, and even and each individual has their pluses and minuses. They have their own individual issues to deal with on top of trying to take care of a teenage girl who is very sick. So a really, really good weepy, not melodramatic. The emotions are heightened and there are some tense scenes, but it doesn't feel forced. So look for Baby Teeth as it's available out there. I also finally checked out the latest film from Spike Lee, The Five Bloods. And yes, the Five Bloods are named after the members of the Temptations. It's set in Vietnam, in which American soldiers have a reunion in Ho Chi Minh City to not only have a reunion with each other, but to find the remains of their squadron leader, played in flashback by Chadwick Boseman, but also a fortune in gold that they buried many, many years ago. So imagine it's sounding like a little bit of the, not to say the Dirty Dozen. There's a lot that Spike Lee borrows at times from for this film, and we kind of expect that with Mr. Lee's work, where he's trying to cover a lot of ground, not just the camaraderie of these soldiers, or these veterans who have a reunion, but there are little nods to Apocalypse Now. That we actually hear Ride of the Valkyries in this. Of course, what the flashback of African Americans in the Vietnam War, especially one of the most vocal African Americans at that time was Muhammad Ali. So we get that. We go down the road on a boat, again, an homage to Apocalypse Now. It kind of goes all over the place, as that often happens in a Spike Lee film. I've learned over time, and I kind of did this with Black Klansman, although I think Black Klansman is a better film, where because he's throwing so much stuff at you, you kind of, but the main crust of it, in that case, it's the investigation. But there was also a buddy cop aspect to Klansman. In this one, it could be it has at times a heist film, like Kelly's Heroes, and at times a lot of it, especially in the second half, turns into Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Say what you will about the film, and it's a flawed film, but what cannot be denied, you have four really good performances from the leads, Clark Peters, Isaiah Whitlock Jr., Norm Lewis, and especially Delroy Lindo, who in this, his character went to war. He, as at the meeting, he is in the reunion, I should say, is a Make America Great hat-wearing black conservative, and has his son with him along the way and brings him into the fold as far as this trip. And the film is about 2.5 hours, and when we get to the halfway mark, he kind of turns in the Fred C. Dobbs for you fans of Treasures of the Sierra Madre. In fact, I believe there's also a moment of somebody saying, "We don't got to show you no stinking badges." There's also a nod to Bridge on the River Kwai with the lion Madness. But seeing him trying to keep things going and then making sure he wants to keep his share of it. It could have been shorter for my taste, but the performances are good, and what he was trying to say about the experience, I understand. But again, it's worth a watch. I don't think it's just not as good as Black Klansman. So, and definitely watch for Delroy Lindo, one of the best performances I have seen this year. All right, and finally, as far as the new material, we also have 7500, a new drama starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a pilot who is taking a flight from Berlin to Paris, and the flight is overrun by terrorists. So, clocking in a little over an hour and a half, it is mostly done in one location, in the cockpit. As a little extra depth, we get a screen of the door of the camera outside the door. So, I guess the pitch is, you can imagine either United 93 or Captain Phillips meets Locke. Locke was the great film with Tom Hardy, in which almost the entire film is him driving, and it's him dealing with situations over the phone and what he's supposed to do next. So thankfully, it's a tight film for the most part, and a lot can happen in 90 minutes in this case. The fact that, and it's a German filmmaker who made this, Patrick Wohlrath, I hope I'm saying that right. But the fact that we get a Muslim terrorist in a drama in 2020, you could have made this a group from anywhere, but that leaves a slight bad taste. But other than that, I'm thankful it didn't go on any longer than it did. Joseph Gordon-Levitt has the brunt of the I should say the majority of the load. It kind of falls on his shoulders. And although in the second half of the film he does have some nice time with Omed Mimar, who plays one of the gentlemen hijackers that's stuck in the cockpit with him. So if you're into Locke or Captain Phillips or United 93, well, there you go. It's out there. And because of watching The Five Bloods, I also revisited Inglourious Basterds. Not Quentin Tarantino's. No, the original Italian war film starring Bo Svenson and Fred the Hammer Williamson. Film sociology, yes, Fred the Hammer Williamson. And this was kind of a knockoff of The Dirty Dozen back in 1978, where a bunch of war criminals who are allies jump a train and wind up going behind enemy lines. And it was a fun revisit of that film, done fairly on the cheap, although you get to see Bo Svenson and especially Fred Williamson do their own stunts. And DVD to the Blu-ray, I should say, also has a conversation with the original director and Quentin Tarantino discussing the impact of this film for Quentin's version of Inglourious Basterds. Fun note, I forgot that this was the film was released on Xenon Video as G.I. Bro. If you wanted to push the Fred Williamson aspect, it was retitled G.I. Bro, but it's actually The Inglourious Basterds from 1978. So fun to revisit that film. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. A few more titles I was able to watch over the week. There are times where, especially when your daughter is 18, and I've been trying to not try to shove suggestions at her. We tried to rotate, and now I've just kind of eased back a little bit. So earlier this week, she'd been wanting to see it, and it just popped up, and we decided to give it a go. But the film that came out earlier this year, Troop Zero, set in Georgia in 1977, about a group of outsiders who form their own scouting girls troop. I don't want to actually say, but you know, one of those off-brand offshoots. It's not the copyright of the girls' organization. You know which one I'm talking about. But the big push in this film is that it stars Allison Janney as the not nice woman and Viola Davis as the caretaker for the offshoot girls troop. Interesting enough, going in early into this film, you have the young girl whose father is a lawyer. She's obsessed with space, but the fact that her father is a Southern lawyer and she has an African-American woman working with her, I don't think Harper Lee has anything to worry about, although it had almost a Trailer Park Atticus Finch feel for a couple minutes. But and it's Jim Gaffigan playing her father. The kids are pretty good. I should say McKenna Grace especially is the daughter named Christmas, who is the outsider and not allowed in the big girl group, so they form their own troop. And so part of it is the camaraderie of the Land of Misfit Scouts that are part of Troop Zero, and it all builds up to a talent show, which, but fun use of David Bowie's Space Oddity, and I'll just leave it at that. I also wondered how many scenes there were going to be between the two Academy Award winners, Allison Janney and Viola Davis. There's four, and it's not just good person, bad person. There's a nice little chemistry between the two of them in their four scenes together. So that is out there. Look for Troop Zero. I did get into my Mystery Science Theater box set and started Being from Another Planet, which was originally known as Time Walker, and it's, you know, what happens when an alien force is buried in King Tut's tomb and it's opened and you terrorize a college campus in the early 80s. Anyway, fun stuff there. As I was saying before, I've been trying to let Emma pick stuff out more. And last Friday, after recording this program, we were together, and it was another one where she'd heard about it. She'd heard about it on a podcast, and we checked it out. The Love Witch. Now, she, full disclosure, she did not know that a classmate of mine from Ball State, Jeff Parise, is as one of the main roles in this as one of the guys, but it's a witch who comes in the town and sets up shop and starts looking for guys. Now, it has, for me, a Italian 70s horror vibe. It's a stylized film with stylized acting. In fact, the acting, while it's fun to watch, you wonder, when I compare it to an Italian horror film from the 70s, is the original acting over the top, or is the dubbing over the top, or is it a combination of both? And if you've watched enough dub films, you sort of know what I'm talking about. But it has that kind of midnight vibe, and fun, and not the most uncomfortable thing I've watched with my daughter and family. So there. I also revisited the special features on Mishima. I talked about that on last week's show, the Paul Schrader film. I do have a correction. The film budget was apparently $5 million, as far as $2.5 million from Japan, $2.5 million from Warner Brothers, and Coppola and Lucas added into their own. Just a reminder, it's one of the best-looking films of that year. That's 1985, and one of the most interesting ones from Paul Schrader, although as the more I got into it, besides being fascinated by Mishima's writing, there's also comparisons that were made to Richard Gere's character in American Gigolo and Robert De Niro's character, Travis Bickle, in Taxi Driver, of guys transforming themselves or preparing themselves for a big action near the end of their stories.
And so that makes sense. Also been watching a PBS documentary series about the history of Broadway and just finished that up today. The other Mystery Science Theater collection that I opened, I mentioned earlier about Time Walker, Teenage Caveman, when a caveman defies tribal laws and starts looking for answers. And it's the teenage caveman is played by then 26-year-old Robert Vaughn, written and directed by Roger Corman. And this was before Vaughn received his Academy Award nomination for The Young Philadelphians. But, it's supposed to be a cave-era film shot in the woods in Southern California. So there's that. And then you get hit with, apparently shot at Corman's Canyon. Those who are Roger Corman fans know what we're talking about. You know, familiar 50s location. And you get a message at the end of the film where it could be the end of civilization as we know it, and we do not feel fine. Fun timing with what we're going through today and watching that. And apparently this was on a double bill with How to Make a Monster. This was the end of AIP's black and white double bill era. So there you go, Teenage Caveman. And I'll finish the other two Mystery Science Theater films in a bit. So that's what I've been watching. Oh, and I forgot to mention this last week, and I apologize. I apologize for all the Gymkhana fans out there. Kurt Thomas, the Olympic gymnast, passed away this week, last week, I should say. And just a blatant excuse to revisit the ridiculous action film Gymkhana. Robert Klaus, the director, Jerry Weintraub, the producer, the men that made Bruce Lee an international superstar with Enter the Dragon. They tried to do that with Jim Kelly and Black Belt Jones. I'm still waiting for The Ultimate Warrior to come out. That's the film with Max von Sydow and Yul Brynner. So waiting for that to get an official video release on that. I'll have to double check and see if Warner Archives has put that out yet or not. And they tried to make a movie action star out of Kurt Thomas. And it's half karate, half gymnastics, a bar in an alleyway in a small Yugoslavian town, as well as the rock pommel horse with the handles. He didn't do any other. Well, he didn't star in any other films after that. But it is a fun, goofy watch anyway. And if you get a chance, Julie DeCaro wrote a nice write up about Kurt Thomas for Deadspin, and she also reminded us that if it weren't for Gymkhana, we wouldn't have American Anthem. So take that for what it is. All right. So yes, thank you, Kurt Thomas, and thank you for Gymkhana. I don't regret it. All right, folks, it's time to grab a pencil. Let's go through what you folks have been watching via Facebook, Twitter, as well as. But we'll start with my buddy Eric, who emails me his reviews, although he says he's not going to write a whole lot about two films that he says that fall in the mediocre category, The Best of Enemies, that's the one with Taraji P. Henson and Sam Rockwell, as well as The Kitchen, the one with Melissa McCarthy, Tiffany Haddish, and Elizabeth Moss, that is no Widows, let's just put it that way. First time viewing for Eric, Edge of Darkness from 1943, which he dubbed as excellent. The Five Bloods, which he dubbed outstanding, so he liked it more than I did. The rewatches for him, Day of the Triffids from 1963, so bad it's awful, as well as Fellini's La Dolce Vita from 1960, which he dubbed as good plus. So thank you, Eric. Heading over to Twitter, Judy Harvey at JUH Harvey, documentary on groundbreaking tennis great Althea Gibson. So thank you there, Judy. Also on Twitter, this is from at Chewy Walrus. Here's what he's watched: The X-Files, I Want to Believe from 2008, The Five Bloods, The Driver, which I happy birthday last week to Bruce Dern. Hard Times, not from 1975, Shirley, and The Day the Earth Stood Still, the 2008 remake. I still need to check out Shirley, and The Driver and Hard Times both were directed by Walter Hill, so not just a Bruce Dern birthday last week. That's all on Twitter. Now, going to last week, because it happens, Steven writes a letter to Momo and all of the Sergei... and all of the film version of War and Peace. Wow. Sergei Bondarchuk's. I hope I'm saying it right. But yeah, Stephen, we have time on our hands. That's okay. Once again, we are stuck inside watching stuff. There shouldn't be complaints about something being too long. So if Stephen can watch War and Peace, you can watch The Five Bloods or The Irishman. So there. Cheryl says, writes, Michael Clayton, a rewatch, The Godfather, a rewatch, and Ready or Not, very good suspense horror escape from the house movie. I've been enjoying time to revisit some of my favorite movies, too. Thank you, Cheryl. Tina writes, The Black Klansman, The Last Measure, Danny Collins, Richard Jewell, and The Hunt. Shannon, thank you. She writes, so I totally missed the deadline. But just wanted to say I finally got around to watching Kingsman, The Golden Circle. Really got a kick out of the Boss Hoss version of Word Up. Ron writes, The Five Bloods. Mason writes, Knives Out and Journey of Dreams, the morphine documentary. Okay, Evan writes, Vampire Lesbos. Thank you, Evan. William writes, The Jerk. Steve Martin, I am finally somebody. Yep. Darren writes, Three Faces of Eve, Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, Tarzan the Ape Man, and Artemis Fowl. Molly chimes in, Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte is one of my all-time favorites. David writes, The Five Bloods. Mary writes, Salem's Lot and The Ghost and Mrs. Muir. The movie, not the TV series. Molly writes, The Vast of Night. Mel writes, Knives Out. Christian writes, Spaceship Earth and Just Mercy. Both were good. Joshua writes, Marshall. Amanda writes, Mr. Wright. Mia writes, Lucy in the Sky, a box office flop. Natalie Portman and John Hamm do not have chemistry on screen, and Natalie started off with a strong accent and then lost it pretty quickly. It just wasn't good. Do not recommend. Nick writes, Silent Trigger, The Hunt, The Vast of Night, Sonic the Hedgehog, Dirty Ho, The Platform, Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, and Emma. That's the most recent one from 2020, which we got to get to. Jackie writes, Parasite, Goon, Gemini Man, and Artemis Fowl. Richard writes, Peaks and Valleys, which is actually opening this weekend in theaters in Wasalia and Kangai, Alaska. Lou writes, Repeat Attenders, Colorado Space, The Madness of King George, a stage production. Eric writes, The Lighthouse. David writes, I'm super excited because Friday, Saturday, Sunday, our local single screen in Attica, the Divan, I went to many movies at the Divan back in the mid-90s, is opening for some classics. 6 p.m. Jurassic Park, 9 p.m. Jaws, all weekend. And then Sunday, 2 and 7 p.m., as well. Next weekend is E.T. and Back to the Future. So, David, congrats on that. And if you happen to be in Western Indiana, check out the Divan in Attica. I am hoping that the sound in the picture is better than when I was there back in 94 and 95. Lisa writes, The Healer. Michelle writes, Knives Out. Cheryl writes, Star Wars, Rise of Skywalker, Men in Black International, The Five Bloods, and 846, the Dave Chappelle special. I understand. And she goes, not exactly a movie. It's okay, Cheryl. You watched it as well. Daniel writes, Captain America, McKellen playing the part, The Cheap Detective, Gaby, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, The Greeks, Small Change, the Truffaut film, Artemis Fowl, For Pete's Sake, Psych Cho, Margaret Cho, Theodora Goes Wild, Tab Hunter, Confidential, Sweet Dreams, The Four Musketeers, Black Panther, Lurid, and Bad Education. Jeff writes, Rush Beyond the Lighted Stage, and Rocky, and Little Miss Sunshine. Jared writes, we watched Artemis Fowl for family movie night, if that counts. Yes, it counts. Aaron writes, Johnny Guitar. I don't know how my family would feel about that one. That's a midnight movie I enjoy. Maria writes, Ocean's 8. Steven writes, Holiday. A real tonic in the midst of a storm. I can't tell you which type of storm, but thank you, Stephen. Jamie writes, Peter Pan and the Simpsons movie. My child is obsessed, so multiple times. Oh, and Artemis Fowl. Lori writes, The Five Bloods. Bruno writes, Saturday Night Fever. Carrie writes, North by Northwest. David writes, Knives Out. Teresa writes, Twilight, Hunger Games, Smokey and the Bandit, and going all the way back, The Wiz. Joe writes, that's Joe Shearer, Skull Island, Kong Skull Island, Jaws, The Five Bloods, A Secret Love, Alt-Right, Age of Rage, Consent, Blood Rage, New Year's Evil, and Microwave Massacre. Thank you, Joe. John writes, Dick Tracy, Heaven Can Wait, White Fang. Guess how old I am. By the way, the 12-year-old who played the kid is now a professor of law. Thank you, John. Bonnie writes, I finally watched one of the worst movies I've ever seen, Phantom of the Paradise. I own that, Bonnie. I don't know what to tell you. Have a couple drinks and we'll try it again. Also, Ready or Not, which was fantastic. James writes, yes, on Knives Out. Oh, and Artemis Fowl. Dana writes, The Disaster Artist. James Franco's portrayal of Tommy Wiseau is amazing. Ashley writes, La Ventura, La Notte, and I'm watching La Eclipse this evening. Melissa writes, The Meddler. Carrie writes, Scoob. I think that's with her kids. Jennifer writes, Loving Vincent. Gregory writes, 1917 and Star Wars, episodes 7 through 9. Roxana writes, The Princess Bride. Rachel writes, The World Is Not Enough, Enter the Warrior's Gate, and the 1993 film version of The Three Musketeers. Jed Bryan, who has been on the show as a guest, this is cool. I watched Fritz Lang's film M, starring Peter Lorre, for the first time. What an amazing film. Jed, I am jealous that you get to experience that for the first time. I took my lovely wife and my buddy Nicole to see that at the Music Box Theater in Chicago. Great experience. Happy I got to see it on the big screen. Jason writes, Blood and Lace, and then adds, holy moly, this was originally rated GP for you fans of the early MPAA ratings. Doug writes, the Netflix series Dear White People, the PBS documentary Mae West, Dirty Blonde, and the 1996 musical biopic The Singing Nun. Linda writes, The Black Butterfly, as well as Official Secrets. Yes, the one with Keira Knightley. Spencer writes, The Wizard of Oz, 7 times in a row. In other words, my little sister is obsessed and gets control of the remote. Spencer, I've been there, not with that, but as I always tell the story, when Emma was really, really young, she could watch and did what alternated every day for almost 6-7 months, it felt like. It was probably longer. But she would alternate between Monsters, Inc. and Finding Nemo. There could be a lot worse that you'd be forced to watch several times a day, every day, for months. So hang in there, Spencer. Megan writes, Abominable and Philomena. Adam writes, What About Bob? Karen writes, The Rounders. Glenn Ford and Henry Fonda, from 1965. Lighthearted, funny, modern, westernish flick about two cowboys. Not the poker film. John Malkovich is not in this. But yeah, The Rounders from 1965. Brianna writes, Tootsie, The Help, and Jerry Maguire. Gary writes, Terror is a Man, Brides of Blood, Mad Doctor of Blood Island, Santo and the Blue Demon versus Dr. Frankenstein. I watched the Santo film from Mystery Science Theater a couple weeks ago, Gary. Great minds watch alike. James writes, Bullet and One Cut of the Dead. John writes, Angel 4 Undercover. And John has watched every Angel film. Yes, the high school girl by day, call girl by night. And if I remember right, it was like a different actress every time playing Angel. Anyway, John also watched Silence of the Lambs. Leslie writes, Onward and Shawshank Redemption. Tracy Foreigner, who's been on this show, finally saw Sword of Trust. JD writes, I watch Ready or Not on some streaming channel. Surprisingly good. Chloe writes, The Hunt and Shirley. Mark Dubeck, who's been on the show, Top Gun and Deep Cover. Great to watch those again. Joni writes, We watched The Help last week. We also started watching the series Modern Love on Amazon. This morning over coffee, I enjoyed the West End production of Fame. I also rewatched the SpongeBob musical this week. I honestly think that people are not paying attention to this silly on the surface, but so relevant for so many things that are happening right now musical. And it is. Thank you, Joni. Bill writes, The Laundromat. Rosanna writes, The Butler, Rocket Man, the Johnny Lee Miller version of Emma, Loving, and I Am Not Your Negro. Eric writes, Love and Mercy, Big Bad Adolescence, and Jeepers Creepers. Samuel writes, I finally saw Jack the Giant Slayer. I thought it was going to be awful, but I realized I have a special little place in my heart that feels good when I hear slash watch fairy tales, and they're allowed to be a little cheesy. Thank you, Samuel. Stephanie writes, Yesterday. Allison writes, Serenity, which was not the movie I thought it was going to be, and it's rare that movies surprise me anymore. Also, Collateral Beauty, which I loved. Diana writes, The Night Clerk, 13th, Horse Girl, Miss Virginia, and Jess Mercy. Elaine writes, Inside Man. Julie writes, Rewatch Knives Out as a family. Well, I'm hoping to do that with mine, Julie. Good call. Mary writes, A Time to Kill. Jay writes, Victoria, Secrets of the Queen. Keith writes, Avatar and the Wizard of Oz. Britt writes, We've mostly binged Twin Peaks this week, but Star Trek, 2009, Priest, Cadillac Records, Austin Powers, Dirty Dancing, Selma, Star Wars The Force Awakens, and The Black Cauldron. Andrea Light writes, Knives Out, I'm a little late to the game. Also, Elevator to the Gallows and the Sophia Loren Marcello Mastroianni film A Special Day. And last Saturday night on TCM, I caught an amazing documentary called Word Is Out, documenting 26 gay men and lesbians in 1977. Never heard of it before, but their stories were captivating. And finally this week, Alan Clough of WFYI and Hamlet fame says he watched The Illusionist. All right. Thank you, friends. So hopefully you have been inspired to watch something based on the titles I've been rattling off for several minutes. And what sometimes happens, and I'm guilty, or I'm happy to say this as well, somebody will bring up a title and I'll have it on my pile and I'll watch it because somebody mentioned it. And there's a couple that were mentioned. So we'll see what happens over the weekend. Of course, it's Father's Day weekend. Fingers crossed. All right, friends, here are some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Before we wrap things up, we got to raise a big old glass to actor Ian Holm, who passed away on Friday. One of these actors, he was 88, always good, even if the material was not. And his credits go all the way back to 1957. And the first thing that I noticed him in, well, chronologically, I guess. I'm going through my pages from IMDb. But obviously the first thing I noticed him in was in Alien in 1979. But going back to 1968, this is the earliest thing I've seen him do. I know he was in The Buffer's Gun as well as The Fixer. But he played Puck in the BBC production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's not the best production, even though you have Judi Dench as Titania. You have the lovers are played by Diana Rigg and Helen Mirren. David Warner's in this as well. And Ian delivers the fastest ending monologue, the If We Shadows, the fastest version of that I have ever seen. And it's a BBC production. And it looks like it was shot in somebody's castle over the weekend and on off days. So, you know, kind of low budget. But to watch the young talent that is now really, really established, it was entertaining to watch. Other noted credits include Oh, What a Lovely War, Nicholas and Alexandra, the 1971 Mary Queen of Scots, Young Winston. He won a Tony for The Homecoming and then did the film version in 1973. Juggernaut, played King John in Robin and Marian, Shout at the Devil, March or Die. Of course, I mentioned he played an android in Alien, and then got an Academy Award nomination in 1981 for Chariots of Fire, punching out straw hats everywhere. Played Napoleon twice, most notably one of the most notable ones in Time Bandits. Was the captain in Greystoke, was in Brazil, Dream Child, Woody Allen's Another Woman, was in Kenneth Branagh's Henry V, played Polonius in Mel Gibson's Hamlet, Kafka, Naked Lunch, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, he played Victor's father, The Madness of King George, Big Night. despite his ridiculous Italian accent, I love Big Night, and he chews up some major scenery, but his character is supposed to be. So Sidney Lumet's Night Falls on Manhattan, The Fifth Element, he's great in The Sweet Hereafter, and not enough people have watched The Sweet Hereafter. A Life Less Ordinary, Existence, Joe Gould's Secret, From Hell, which is the Hughes Brothers film from 2001. That's also got a weird little footnote in my existence. That was the first film Jonathan and I reviewed on Fox 59 AM 1,000 years ago. And of course, he played Bilbo in Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, and Return of the King, and played old Bilbo in the Hobbit films. But he also was in Garden State, The Aviator, Strangers with Candy, and I think my daughter's first introduction to him was the voice of Skinner in Ratatouille. So thank you, Sir Ian. Salute. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. And I hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're staying healthy. And remember, when it comes to movies, it's easy to fall back on the stuff you know and love, and that's fine. But also try to experience a film you've not seen before. And let me know next week. We're going to end this week's show with a little musical tribute to singer Vera Lynn. If anything else, you know her contribution to the end of Doctor Strangelove, and I'll end it properly. So anyway, hope to hear from you online, and we'll be back next week. So until next time, take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. Okay, here's my setup for Vera Lynn.
Mon Führer, I can walk.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!